Hello and welcome to the next episode of Lost in Criterion. I'm John Patrick Orantari Dorgan, and with me, as always, is a man who metaphorically has the metaphorical huge balls of a metaphorical bull.
I am the Adam Glass, and I'm metaphors all the way down.
Yep. Well, until you hit the elephants, but yeah.
The literal elephants that all of my...
Yes, they hold your balls up.
It's true. Pat, before we get into the movie this week, I want to talk about our Patreon. It's patreon.com/lostincriterion. Over there for $1 a month, you can help keep us going and get access to some bonus content. Over there for $1 a month, you can help keep us going and get access to that bonus content. We do a non-Criterion film over there every month from a list I put together on whatever whim I'm feeling, sometimes based on a celebrity who has passed away recently, sometimes based on another movie we've watched recently. Sometimes because Criterion decided to show us one film from a director
and never,
and
we'll
never show
others.
Us another film from that director, and we were so impressed that we want to do at least one more from them. But yeah, we have a lot of good times. It's a pretty eclectic mix of movies. Instead, that's all $1 gets you access to the new episodes over there, the vote, and also the entire back catalog of over 75 episodes as well. A little above that, $5 supporters, folks who help us pay our bills a little bit more. We love them so much that we thank them on air. And thank you so much to our $5 supporters, Andrew Jarrett, Eric Coronado, Stephen Goldmeyer, and Chris Otto.
Yes, thank you.
Above that, we do something pretty dang special. Pat makes a piece of art based on one of the movies we watched recently. I get that printed up on a postcard, write a little personalized thank you note, and mail that off to our $10 and above supporters. We'd also like to thank them on air, and thank you so much to Nina Bojnak, Jason Westhaver, Tracy McGrath, Patrick Yako, and Adam Speakerman, our $10 and above supporters.
Thank you to you as well.
If you want to see those postcards without committing to that $10 mark, head over to redbubble.com, search for Lost in Criterion there. Our store will pop up, and you can see all the past postcards and just bask in their glory. But if you feel like it, you could also purchase them as postcards, greeting cards, stickers, magnets, a few other things in the mix as well.
Bike repair patches. Slap that bad boy on there.
Thank you to everybody who has purchased anything off that Redbubble over the years. Thank you to all our Patreon supporters over the years. And thank you for listening.
Thank you so much.
Pat.
What?
This week, we've got the moment of truth.
I've been saying it for years.
Yeah. We've been building to this, this.
Well, actually, we've decided to end the podcast today. This is it. This is the moment of truth.
This is
when it's happening. I know it seems a little random, but here it goes. Isn't that how most podcasts end?
The
people just like don't make it anymore.
Yeah, but I don't think they announced the last.
This is the last we're going to do. We far, far past where we're supposed to do that. We looked that mile marker and dead in the eye, and we just kept driving, and here we are, fucking 500 and whatever the fuck it is.
In my experience, most podcasts that end, you're about 3 years after the end when you think, oh, that was the last episode, I guess.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't know what it's like when it ends for the person who does it, because I've never ended a podcast. Yeah. Well, actually, that's not true. We did end one. But we made an active decision. We're like, we're not fucking going to do this anymore. Otherwise, most of the time what happens is you have it in your podcast feed player thingamajigger, and like you go, huh, that hasn't updated in a really long time. And then usually what happens after that is you get a new phone and you just never download that one again.
There you go.
Just
yeah.
Gets pruned.
Right. Yeah. Now, The Moment of Truth is from 1965. It is directed by Francesco Rosi. We have seen a couple of films from Rossi before, both the movies he made before this. Salvatore Giuliano was many, many years ago. We watched it at Spine 220-something, I think. Spine 228. And then a little more recently, but still quite a few years ago, Hands Over the City. from spine number 355. Those were 1962 and 1963, respectively. And Hands Over the City won the Golden Lion, but was not exactly a commercial venture. Imagine the people of Italy did not rush to the theater to watch a movie about how corruption in Italy led to public housing collapsing. Physically collapsing, not
right. I mean, I think probably the physical collapse is the part that makes that unpalatable. What I mean is, like, because, like, think about it. Movie audiences love watching movies about the corruption of their own politicians. Like, that's like a thing that they love. It's really probably the physical collapse of the infrastructure that was probably the thing that made people a little uncomfortable.
Hands Over the City won at the Venice Film Festival, and after that, Rossi seems to have decided that a way to sort of have a built-in commercial success would to be an international joint production. Because then you've got two countries who can sort of
ignore
your movie.
Right, you've got two countries whom you can make mad / uncomfortable.
Yeah. So also along that around that time, he was approached by why is the producer not on here?
I mean, I don't know what you're looking at, because
the producer's name.
The Wikipedia page for this movie is four sentences.
Yeah, but it doesn't have the producer on it.
I mean, maybe there wasn't
which
one.
Which is where
I would like to point out a thing about the Wikipedia page. Not that this is the Wikipedia commentary hour while you hunt for the producer, which is there are four sections. Like normal, there's a sort of intro. There's the plot, the cast, the reception. The reception is one sentence long and says it needs expansion, according to Wikipedia's moderators. The plot is also only one sentence long, but apparently doesn't need further expansion.
Yeah.
Seems very selective to me, is what I'm saying. Whoever decided to mark one section and not the other.
After Hands Over the City won the Golden Lion, he was approached by Angelo Rizzoli, who was a film producer in Italy, who essentially said, "Hey, what do you want to do next?"
He's like, "I want to make a movie about a bullfire." Who's a metaphor for the ills of capitalism.
Well, he didn't.
Okay,
he didn't actually.
Okay, great.
So Rossi got on this idea of a dual country production. So what he came back to Rizzoli with was an idea for just a straight documentary about the running of the bulls. And
I mean,
the
to
whole,
be fair, that probably would have also been very popular.
The whole Festival de San Fermin. And that we get quite a bit of that in this film. But he went and he started filming it, and he was writing a plot.
He just couldn't help himself. fuck, I accidentally made a movie. Shit.
So, the vast majority of people in this film are essentially playing themselves. They are non-actors.
As indicated by the fact that literally none of these names have a link to any meaningful Wikipedia page.
Right, right.
Just all red.
Our star, Miguel Romero, is a matador. Basically, all of his handlers are played by themselves. The only commercial actress in the entire movie is Linda Christian as Linda, the American woman who seduces him.
They had to pay somebody to kiss this man on camera. That's all I'm saying.
Had to pay somebody to kiss this man on camera. That is fair. But yeah, so so he's writing this whole movie by the seat of his pants. He had Rossi says in the one bonus feature on the disc. Rossi says that he'd been a huge fan of Hemingway, and as such, figured if Hemingway can know nothing about Spain and go to Spain and make a bullfighting book, he can do the same thing with the movie. So he goes to Spain with two cameramen and a sound guy. And then one of the cameramen quit. Cinematographer Gianni De Venazzo couldn't handle the animal cruelty.
Yeah, it's understandable.
Like, I don't want to shoot more. I don't want to shoot more bloody bulls. So he left, and Rossi in the interview, it's very silly, because he gives the man an out. He says, "Oh, he had been hired to make a movie with Fellini, and one that movie is, I believe, 8.5."
There's a certain. I mean, Fellini. He kind of went to one form of animal cruelty to another, but yeah,
yeah. But also, this guy absolutely left because he did not want to shoot.
Hey, man, like it's very understandable. Anymore. This movie is fucking overwhelming. Yeah. You're like, God damn.
Yeah.
There's a lot of bull murder in this movie.
The Technicolor and Technoscope just pop that so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because you get on the Wikipedia, you can see this poster that looks like it's just the cover of a zine, and one of its hallmark things on it just says color.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like that seems like they're underselling it, really. There's a lot of fucking blood in this movie.
It is the color of the blood that... that really makes that. It might have been Juliet of the Spirits, actually, timing wise, not 8.5 that he left to film. But in any case, David Nanzo stepped away, and his assistant Pasqualino De Santis shot the whole thing. Most of the bullfighting is shot with a telephoto lens that had previously only been used for soccer games.
Cool.
That was apparently incredibly hard to focus.
Yeah,
to keep in focus.
You can understand that because, like, they're doing an admirable job, but it falls out of focus all the fucking time. Like, it just happens all the time.
Yeah.
It still looks fantastic. Like, yeah. I mean, it just is very, very good.
Absolutely. One of Rossi's biggest things in wanting to make a movie once he decided he was making a movie about a matador was he didn't want to do the thing that every other Hollywood or otherwise movie about bullfighting does and have his very attractive star suddenly replaced by stunt doubles whenever the bullfighting actually happens.
Right.
So that's one reason why he found an actual bullfighter who could star in his movie. And he talks about how some of the bullfighting accidents in the movie, the ones that don't have an explicit thing going on with the plot, like in the one match where he falls to the ground and is face down for a second while everyone scares the bull off. Some of those were just the nature of bullfighting.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of figured that.
It accidentally happened, and they left it in.
Like, except for the one at the end, my sort of interpretation is like, well, I mean, because, I mean, it's, you know, Google doesn't know anything about anything, but its description of this being a documentary is that it still feels very true, despite the fact that I know there's a plot happening here. When push comes to shove, it feels like a documentary, and I think the part of, you know, obviously based on what you just said, but just in general, like part of the reason that is the case is because it a lot of time, like I mean, you put a man and a bull in a ring, and said, and then recorded a bullfight, right? Like I mean, you just did, right? Like it just is what it is.
Yeah, yeah, and when you have real people doing their real actions, even if they're scripted conversations, it's still documentarian in a lot of ways, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when you get into, like, something very, very akin to true, like, cinema veritas and stuff, right? Yeah. In the sense that, like, you've got a matador, and, like, unlike a lot of what we've dealt with a lot of, like, New Wave and stuff, where, like, well, I got non-actors, and then I coached the shit out of them and made them say what I wanted to say and molded them. And, like, this feels much more akin to what you would imagine that movement or something like that would be, which is, just letting the matador do matador shit and then occasionally telling him what to say to the camera.
Right. We've approached this from the other side of that line, documentaries that get too close to fiction.
Right.
Whereas this is a fiction movie that gets real, real close to documentarian. And not just, you know, we've had that with, like, ethnography before.
Right.
Where a fiction film is essentially performing ethnography. And, you know, one could argue that that is.
I mean, that is. You one could definitely say that's what. I mean, like, of course, the problem with, like, fiction film by nature, because you're telling them what to say, you're never really going to do. But I would argue that you're getting pretty close here because presumably the matadors aren't going to want to say things that aren't true to what they.
Right.
You know what I mean? They're going to give you pushback on, like, hey, I'm not going to say that or whatever. Because they are actual matadors, they're not going to want to like spoil their own reputation and stuff, right? So, it's a really fascinating, like sort of gray area that we're existing in here. You know, we're getting into the territory of like, if I needed to like explain, like this is never going to happen. But if as a you know, if I were a teacher, you know, in something like an anthropology department, and I wanted to teach people, like we wanted to talk about bullfighting. You know, you'd be in a really interesting gray area here where you'd be like, well, yeah, but this is like a really good encapsulation of that idea and the sorts of lives, the life that it is and like everything like that. So you could like, well, I mean, it's not actually an ethnography, but like at the same time, like you're pretty fucking, you know, you've got a lot of what you need there. I don't know. It's fascinating. It feels very, very authentic is what I'm saying. When it all comes down to it, he's captured a very, very sincere feeling.
Yeah. And of course, the vast majority of the festival scenes are authentic documentary, right?
Right. Yeah. They're just pointing the camera at it, basically, right? So,
yeah.
Well, again, so seemingly is most of the bullfighting, right? Like,
yeah.
I'm sure those horses were not really game for what was happening for most of this movie.
Right. Right. Introducing a horse to the situation just seems like.
Well, it's really fascinating because, like, I don't understand anything about bullfighting, okay?
Right.
And I don't really want to. This movie was interesting. I got a lot out of it, but at the same time, it's like, I don't want to know more than what I already was already sort of forced to learn. It sort of seems like, because they got a very, like, Spanish conquistador sort of vibe to the guy on the horseback.
Right.
And then, like, it's like, there's just a lot of stabbing going on.
Yeah,
just a generally substantial amount of stabbing. He's doing stabbing, and then you introduce this horse. This horse is wearing armor, but on one side of its body, it's very like.
I
feel bad for that horse. I feel bad for the bull too, but you know what I mean.
I love what this exposes me to about the nature of bullfighting, and how all of the lesser bullfighters are just there to weaken the bull before the very famous guy gets up and does the death blow. And that is not to imply that anyone has an easier job than anyone else.
For real, because, like, one of them eventually has to just have not even the fucking, like, flag thing and just be like, fuck it.
Yeah.
Come at me, bull.
Yeah. But just the nature of it being a whole bunch of people. Like, the one scene where they completely cornered the bull, they're completely surrounding it. It's just.
Well, it's fascinating. Like, I don't know, like, what greater truths about life or something you can. There are some in here for sure. Anyway, but like, it's like a lot of times you're just like watching, like, you're sort of like in one part of your brain, you almost have to like exist in multiple like sort of mental spaces at the same time. Because at one point you're like, how is this a sport? How is what I'm watching a sport? And then you think to yourself, yeah, but like, how is football a sport? Like, I don't, like, what's a sport? Like, what is any sport really? Like, I don't, you know, it's, but it does seem fascinating that so many people are watching this, what appears to be basically a, like a beef roast gone bad. Like, right? I mean, it's basically what we're watching, like an entire, like, I mean, the crowds are like phenomenal. It's every stadium's fucking packed.
Right. And that's always been historically true, but I don't think you can separate the circus, as in bread and circuses aspect of this, from Spanish politics every century.
Right.
Now, obviously, what we're filming here, and Rosie gets into this a little bit in the interview too. When we're filming here, we're in the middle of Francoist Spain, right? You know, that's one of our opening shots. We have the pageantry of the San Ferran Festival of 50, you know, two dozen, three dozen men under this huge golden statue of the Virgin Mary, who are sweaty. They've got to take snack breaks, carrying this thing as part of a parade out of...
which is a thing I want to talk about in a minute when you're done. But yeah.
And that Catholic pageantry is something that Franco was very invested in. The alignment of Catholicism and fascism in Spain in that time. But to even hammer that home, Rossi shows us the soldiers who are also marching as part of that parade, right? This is a civil religion parade, not just a Catholic festival.
Right. Well, and that's part of the imposition and like nature of fascist like sort of
right.
You know, political expression, right? It's like the what would have prior been an explicitly religious festival becomes
right
functionally part of the fascist state, right?
And which, I think to a certain extent, Franco is just inheriting that aspect of San Ferran. I think the running of the bulls has always been a function of the state, not a function of the religion, principally. And certainly the two are one throughout most of Spanish history.
And a lot of states' history.
Yeah, and a lot of states' history. So yeah, I say this because the color of the bullfighting, the popping here made me think of Goya does bullfighting paintings, Picasso does bullfighting paintings. Goya's are interesting because generally speaking, Goya's bullfighting paintings are just attributed to Goya liking bullfighting because no one paid him to make those. Like most of his most famous works were commissioned works. Goya just did the bullfighting stuff on his own. But at least one scholar does argue that there's a political message in Goya's bullfighting that posits bullfighting as a resistance to the dominant order, as the bull representing the state and people fighting against that state.
That's fascinating. I would always almost like, I mean, and I think this movie does posit as an argument that it's quite the opposite.
Right.
Like,
right. Yeah. The bull is a victim of the state in as much as the bullfighters are victims of the state.
Exactly. I mean, this movie, a movie very clearly in no uncertain terms argues that the bull, that Miguel and the bull are basically the same thing. That they're both victims of this system,
of capitalism,
right? Of capitalism. Yeah. I mean, it is capitalism. It is and an expression of the idea that fascism as a sort of tool of capitalism, and the idea that
Picasso's
the people in the stands are also like them. I mean, they're all, everybody's all this thing except for like the whoever happens to be in charge, right?
Yeah, Picasso's bullfighting paintings, his most famous one. There is an interpretation that Picasso is working a classist critique into his painting with the shadow and the shade of the bullfighting ring itself, being that the seats in the shade are where the rich people get to sit. I don't know if just looking at that painting gives you that, and that's more maybe reading a little more into it than the piece itself, but certainly it's there. But yeah, it's just, there's a very paint quality to the Technicolor.
Right. I mean, Technicolor just has that as a sort of, like, Technicolor always has a nearly painterly feel to it. Like,
yeah.
Anyway. And when you add in the fact that, like, right here in this particular element, we have these extremely intense pops of color forced against what is a fundamentally drab background all the time, right? It's just dirt and sand, right?
Right.
And I mean, that's part of the effect of the bullfighting and the Matador costumes anyway, right, is that they're bright, these bright colors.
Right.
They're waving around a bright, you know, bright piece of fabric. But, like, then you combine that with the blood of the animal. Like, it all pops intensely against gray. Or not gray, against a drab sort of tan color.
Yeah. Yeah, the tan, the beige of the sand. This is a movie that was pretty hard to come by for a long, long time. The essay written by Peter Matthews gets into it a little bit to say it was originally reviewed very, very well on its release by American sources.
Uh-huh. I mean, yeah, it seems like the New York Times liked it.
But now considered one of Rossi's lesser works and mostly not talked about, and when it is talked about, it is said to be full of cliché. And he does ape a lot from Hollywood Matador movies, certainly.
I don't know that I've ever seen one.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I may not be the right person to ask because I don't think I've ever seen a movie about Matador. The closest thing I've ever seen is the episode of Columbo that features Matadors.
Right. But I really think there's, despite, you know, Rossi says he's walking a thin line. Rossi says, I'm working in Franco, Spain. The censors wanted to cut a whole bunch of stuff, but I successfully argued against them. But he also points out, you know, he thinks there is Spanish society in this movie, a real look at Spanish society in this movie, but understanding the political climate of where he was working, he couldn't make Salvatore Giuliano again here, right? He couldn't be that openly defiant,
right?
And get this movie.
And I get, right. But I think that in some ways, to me personally, that works in benefit of this movie in some ways, because this movie is very subtly but very clearly about the thing it's about, right? Like, it is about, I mean, we know exactly why Miguel gets into this line of work.
Yeah.
He restates that argument multiple times because there are people pushing him to try to, like, his manager, everybody is operating under the belief that he wants to be famous.
Right.
And he is overtly clear many times that, like, I am doing this to make money.
Yeah.
I'm here to make money.
Right.
And as soon as I have enough of it, I'm going to get the fuck out, right? The problem is that Rossi makes the very clear and cogent argument that time doesn't exist.
Right.
Those pressures will exist no matter how much money you make.
Yeah.
And it will kill you. Like, and it ends with a very straightforward message with it. Guess what? It's going to fucking kill you.
Yeah.
Just the same as it's going to kill everybody watching this movie, right? Like, it's going to kill. It's what it does.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The idea that, you know, I think we could probably guess really quick what the things the censors didn't like. And that was all the stuff about him being working class when he arrives in the city. Getting, you know, he comes to the city from the provinces to make money. He can't find a job. He ends up staying in a flop house with a numbered cot.
Just an obvious nightmare, right? Yeah. Like, we the entire audience is meant to look at that and go, are you fucking kidding me right now? Right.
Yeah. And Matthew's essay posits that Rossi was also attempting to internationalize the sort of argument he was making in Hands Over the City, that economic development in the North is always built on the backs of a provincial South that is kept in poverty.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a fair perspective on it. I mean, I don't think he gets that much into that particular element of it, But I mean, we do see like the idea of that corruption, right? Is pretty. You can guess another thing that they wanted to cut out would be like the fact that like the only person who can get him a job is a moneylender who will scrape 20% off of his pay,
right?
Or whatever, like every week. Like it's 15, like, well, that's why I can't remember the number. It doesn't.
Well,
it's not
no.
Really, my point being.
Sorry, 15 is what his manager is eventually taking, and he's arguing.
Right, right, but like the moneylender who could get him a job was taking some massive amount of his weekly pay in exchange for getting him a job. Like that's a fundamentally broken system, right?
Right.
It's meant to exploit those same workers.
Yeah.
While it, both financially and physically, while they build whatever sort of economic boom is happening in the North, right?
Right. But we have a parallel to his manager that's meant to be the same thing. And these are the same corrupt forces that need their hands slicked so that everything gets
well,
done.
Well, just the idea, like, later on we get his manager say, like, well, I couldn't change it if I wanted to. Like, what are you talking about? Like, what a nonsensical thing to say. Like, it's beyond me. The forces, it's out of my hands. Like, you know, you're the person taking the money. I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
You could make your cut zero if you wanted to. You could do anything you want.
Yeah.
You're actually the boss, right? Like, that's the thing, right? Is the manager, just like the moneylender, is a middleman. He's not exactly the boss, right? But he takes his end out first, right? It's.
So this is a guy who moves to the city to try and get a better job and make money. And it ends up the only job he can find where he makes money is... murdering bulls for sport, a inherently incredibly dangerous job, no more dangerous than factory work, certainly, but also a lot fewer people doing it. So, you know, your chances
right.
of
well,
being
I mean,
murdered.
Like it's one of those things where it's like, yes and no, more dangerous than factory work in the sense that like. The factory work can, by its nature, be made safer by you know, the factory owners are not going to do that. There's no incentive for them to do that, but it could be. I don't know that, like, whereas the bullfighting is as a representative more of capitalism more broadly, is it as a concept cannot be made safer.
Well, you can put a horse in between you and the bull sometimes. So.
Right. I mean, again, yeah. Well, what I mean is like, is that like it? The bullfighting becomes much more of a broader metaphor of like, yeah. But this system is always going to be dangerous, right? Like the system is always going to take its blood out. With you know, individual factory jobs themselves can be made safer, but they won't be because the system itself, can't be made safer. It's not capable of being safer.
Right. During, you know, the beginning of the third act, where he wakes up in a cold sweat from this nightmare where he's upside down staring in the eyes of the bull. And his manager comes in and says, "What, you're not dressed yet?" And Miguel gets this big, long explanation about how he's alienated, he's depressed, he's scared. And the manager's just like, "Yeah, all matadors are scared. It's just the nature of the business. Get to work. Don't worry about it."
We're meant to like... Well, go ahead. Sorry.
And then he goes to die, right? That immediately precedes the big climactic death.
I mean, you know, at worst, you could accuse Rossi of being a bit on the nose as far as like, hey, I'm going to tell you a story about capitalism. Here you go.
Yeah.
It's like... Because, like, you know, the manager gives him this, you know, cajoles him about, like, oh, they're all scared. It's like, we are meant to despise them. The manager is just trash, right? Like, he's just, like, he's telling the person who's going to go die, well, like, you just got to suck it up and get to work. While his job is to sit there and collect money off of people being told to suck it up and go die in a ring, right? Like it's crazy. It's we're supposed to look at this and go, this is fucking insane. This makes none of this makes any goddamn sense.
And that's what the bosses are, right?
Yeah.
Across the board. Yeah.
I would say that like and I think in that way, right, like we're getting into a I rather than calling it cliched, I would almost call it sublime. Almost like,
yeah.
I don't know how to describe it, but like paring down the story of the ills of capitalism to such a tight degree where you're like, it's so hard to misread it.
Yeah.
I think there's something kind of beautiful about that.
Rossi says that upon its release, the Spanish found it to be among the best movies about the bullfights. And that's sort of... There's the extent where you can satirize something and show it to the person you're satirizing, and they just think you're celebrating it.
Right.
Which is, you know, perhaps a sign up of bad critique. I imagine any outsider looking at this has to realize, it's impossible not to realize, that the way this movie built, just from the opening of the ceremony and closing with the festival as well, that all of this religious pomp and circumstance, all of this gold and glitter, all of this, even the silvery suits of the matadors and picados, all of the army uniforms, and we see, you know, not just the marching army at the beginning, but we see soldiers enjoying the bullfighting at points, particularly in that final sequence. All of that is just a cover of the barbarism that is the state of being,
right
here, right?
Well, and I am always cautious to I go back and forth on this. We've talked about this a lot. Where it's like, oh, well, you can like, this sort of the idea there's no such thing as a like true anti-war film, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Maybe. But at the same time, on the flip side, is that it's really hard to gauge whether an audience is engaging with, like, you know, okay, for example, okay, like you got something like, we watched Fight Club a long time ago, and we talked about the fact that, like, well, your critique of masculinity fails if in some capacity if people just read it as a sort of like positive endorsement of masculinity or something like that, right? But on the flip side of that is that, like, when you have like a broad audience of society saying, well, this is the best version of this kind of story, one has to wonder whether or not that audience is only purely engaging with the bullfight part of it, or if they're also on some deeper level engaging with the idea of like, well, I know who my bullfighters are. I understand that they are exploited, like, young men from the countryside. You know what I mean? Like, because you see that in movies about other sports too, where it can't just, I don't know that I fully believe it's just the sport that people are enjoying watching in the movie format. You know what I mean? There's something else that's, because anybody could point a camera at the fucking bullfights, you know what I mean, and record them and show them. Something about the story has to, like, engage with the audience. And I'm guessing it's the fact that, like, the audience does get something out of, like, engaging with the uncomfortable truth that the reason why these things happen is because some young guy from the country is participating in this blood sport for money, right? And that, like, they are – and that they – and on a deeper level, the audience – at least some percentage of the audience has to understand that, like, well, they wouldn't be doing this if it weren't for the fact that they need money, right? Because when you look at lots of the better versions of the sports films that are made in the United States, they do somewhat engage the audience in the idea of, like, well, why is this young person, like, the bad ones are the ones where, like, I just want, like, where the ones where it's like, I just have always wanted to be a superstar, right? Like, or I've always wanted to be, like, those ones are the ones that audiences don't usually engage very well with. It's more the ones where, like, there's some sort of, like, discussion of, like, the, you know, the person's past or something. I don't think it's just like an endorsement of it in the sense that, like, yeah, I mean, you know, we've talked about the Nazis being our extreme example, is like them not noticing the movies that, like, are criticisms of them that, like, work in this way where they're like, no, this is just a great film about how awesome we are. And then it's like, right, the ones that they get mad about are the ones that are like, Where they're like, right. Wait a minute, are you criticizing us? It's like somehow, like if you go far enough, yes, the people who are being satirized think that you're just lauding them, basically.
Right.
So it's hard to say, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, this is a movie about a guy who just wants to live a comfortable life, wants to make enough money to retire.
Wants to buy his mother a phone.
Wants to buy his mom a phone. Who, at the peak of his fame, still has to go home and get seasonal agriculture work.
Right. It's told that we're told is like being made rich, but we see basically no evidence that he's becoming rich, right? Like he...
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like his manager's like, I'm making you rich. And it's like... Well, we're not getting a lot of evidence that that's the case.
He gets the shiny red car that is presumably his, that he drives around for a bit. But yeah, for the most part, it is... a lot of other people are getting rich off of him. So
yeah.
So he's got that going. But yeah, he's not. And then, you know, his... The whole thing with Linda Christian is
that part's so weird. That part's really weird.
I think it is so sped through. It seems like instead of playing to the cliche of the Hollywood Matador movie, Rosie is actively mocking the cliche of the Hollywood.
I think so. I do think that is true. I think that part's in there to... I do think that part does want to get across the idea that he is, at best, a sideshow.
Right.
For society, right? Like, for those Hollywood, for that group of, like, sort of erudite, like, sort of bougie group, he is included so long as he is just as much an entertainment factor there as he is when he's in the ring, right? Like, he's there for their entertainment. Including hers, right?
Before she decides she wants to have sex with him, she openly mocks how much he's eating.
Right.
Makes him perform.
I mean, we get a very classic, like, country bumpkin sort of like, oh, look at him shoveling the food into his face. Like he's
right. Yeah. Yeah.
You put a guy who's probably been hungry his entire life in a room full of food and then made fun of him for eating it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and that, you know, you do get into this edge of cliche where, like, but at the same time, like, that cliche is meaningful in the sense that, like, that is an accurate representation of the way people who've never seen a ton of food in their entire life, you know,
right,
would want to act in a situation where they're exposed to an abundance of food, right?
Yeah. Yeah, which I think is just another indication that even this far into his career, into his fame,
yeah, he's not walking around eating well. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. He still doesn't have ready access to
well, and material. I think we're supposed to see, like, you know, I was saying that, like, he's entertainment for them. He's brought there essentially as entertainment for these people. But it's worth noting that in addition to that is he's become wealthy according to his manager, right? He's made the big time. He's nowhere near the strata of world that they're in, right? That they just exist in permanently. The place where they just float continuously is he can flutter up there for just a half a second, be mocked and shot down, and then disappear again.
Right.
Even in all, like, I mean, he's running full time as a matador all the time throughout the season, playing every show, theoretically making the maximum amount of money that a matador can make.
Right.
And he's nowhere near this level of society at all. They have to pull him up into it. He can't go up there himself.
And, you know, a reminder that one of the explicit aspects of how hard he's being run is that everyone making money off him also wants him to keep from forming relationships. They don't want him to meet a woman. I mean, ultimately, I think this remains subtext, but they don't want him to meet anyone he would care enough about to not want to risk his life, right?
Right, yeah, absolutely, yeah. He's not supposed to make friends, he's not supposed to have loved ones, he's not supposed to have anything, right? His mother is like, they're constantly sort of pushing him away from the, like, we see that with the phone and stuff, is like a way to like buy him off of the fact that like he does care enough about his mother. Like, it work ends up working for them in the opposite direction because he wants to take care of her, right? And
right.
Like, so he has to keep doing this to be able to do that, right? Yeah, no, absolutely. It's they're actively pushing him away from forming any sort of meaningful connection to any other. I mean, they're actively alienating him from his fellow man. It's just fascinating because, like, they don't. I don't know. Like, I, the movie just does. It's so. It reminds me of the idea that, like, you can have a very, you know, something very well written oftentimes is sparse in its language, right? It,
yeah.
It doesn't waste words, and this movie doesn't waste visually its time and energy. The bullfights are brutal. They're longer than they feel like they should be to emphasize to the audience just how fucking grossly brutal they are. I mean, you know, like, yeah, I mean, I guess some people would watch it and who are already sort of acclimated to that just being what sport is, and would enjoy it. But I think for most of the audience that's sort of intended for it, it is meant to feel, wow, this is what the fuck is happening here? Like, so you end up watching the movie and going to your, at least I do, end up spending a lot of my time going, holy shit, this movie is like really like overwhelming in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
For a movie that has like, what, like maybe 1,000 fucking words in it total? It's
right,
got almost no dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's, it is, obviously, I am someone we've established has, I've described it as animal cruelty. I've talked about the blood. I've called it barbarism. I don't like bullfighting. I think it's,
well, of course. Yeah, I mean, I don't
sport.
Think we're anybody's gonna. I mean, I know there are people who argue with you about that, but like, no, of course.
I cannot imagine a viewing of this film where just the human reactions to the bulls is not read as condemnation of the bullfighting. Like, everyone here is living in fear. Everyone, like, all of them. He only becomes, he gets his first starring action because the previous most famous matador is too scared to interact with this particular bull, right? Says it's too big. But frequently, you know, he's hiding a little bit behind the fence. He's being trampled. You know, people are getting gored and stomped on. And it's not valorized in my reading at all.
No, I don't think so. I don't. I mean, I think the movie, like, you know, again, we might have the problem of no such thing as an anti-war film, but like,
yeah.
Rossi's certainly making a valiant effort to not make anybody who's not already inclined to believe so look at this and go, wow, how brave, how cool, right? Like,
right.
We are supposed to look at Miguel and not go, wow, this is a brave person. We're supposed to look at him and go like, wow, look at how desperate this man is.
Right.
That he's willing to do this.
Yeah. And it murders him. Right?
And then, I mean, and in the end it kills him, right? And to me, that's the biggest sort of like thing about it is that like, even if you're an audience of Spanish like moviegoers who are inclined to think bullfighting is a valid and good sport and that these are good renditions of it, the hero in the end is unceremoniously murdered by the bull, right? The bull just kills him. It's not interesting, it's not exciting, it's not some special event. We don't even get any sort of dramatic tension building in the way that, like, you know, in a movie about, like, if you were going to be like, okay, I'm going to make a Hollywood film about bullfighting, right? And you're going to have like a standoff, right? You're going to almost have like a sort of like showdown in the OK Corral kind of thing. You're going to cut into the bull close up, right, on his face. You're going to cut in on the matter, and the bull is going to charge, right? You're going to have all this setup to build up tension about this final fight. So even if you're going to kill the matador, like, you're going to build up in the mind of the audience this sort of, like, dramatic tension where, like, well, this is the final showdown. Whoever wins and whoever loses, we as the audience won. Whereas here, he just gets killed. It just fucking kills him. Because that's what actually happens, right? That's how these things work. There's no dramatic moments. There's no climax. It just fucking kills you.
Yeah.
And then you're not important anymore. You die in a hole in some back room while somebody maybe makes a decent effort to stitch you back together. Talking essentially to your fucking boss about, yeah, like, tell my mother I love her, right, which he will probably never deliver.
And if you don't die,
now you don't make money anymore. You are delivering that message to your mother itself is not even a profitable endeavor.
And if you don't die, your only hope for a retirement is to become another cog in the machine. Is to train,
right,
your
replacement. You become the guy we meet at the very beginning who trains people to become bullfighters.
Yeah.
Who has to tell himself that he's, like, giving these men, like, their dreams when he knows full well, as everybody else does, that what he's doing is recruiting young
desperate
men who
people
are desperate to a machine to, like, be ground down, to be torn apart.
A kid who looks like he's maybe 14, who we'd, you know, met two scenes earlier. Yeah.
And that we're all supposed to look at, like, viewing it from inside the system, his sort of desperate jump into the ring to, like, participate in that first fight to, like, prove his bravery. Yeah. We're supposed to see that, like, we as the audience, obviously from Rossi's perspective, are not supposed to see it this way. But, like, in the fiction, sort of in the kayfabe of the actual system, oh, that's just bravery. And in reality, it's just desperation, right? Even in this situation, even now that he's involved in this even more exploitative system than the one that he was originally in, which is just general factory work and building work. We have to pretend like he does this because he wants to, rather than because he's forced to, right? This idea that, like, we're all, you know, we constantly are stuck in this sort of cycle of, like, well, like, you chose this job, or, like, this is the job you asked for. It's like, nobody's asking for any of this. Like, nobody wants to do this shit. Just have to.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but everybody's supposed to buy into the fiction that, like, oh, well, he's just so brave. He just couldn't help himself. He was just so full of vim vigor that he had to jump into the ring and participate. It's like, no, he's just desperate. Listen. He needs to be able to actually get into fights, into the contest, so that he can at least start making money on it.
If it had been possible for him to break into a foundry and start rolling sheet metal.
Right, exactly.
To,
like,
prove that he
exactly
could do it.
The same thing, right?
He would have done it, right?
Right, exactly, right? Like, and, like, the reality of the matter is that this job has slightly different but, like, at the same time, think about it. The beginning of the movie presents to him an argument, right? When he's sitting at the sort of cafeteria type table where they're all kind of, like, the flop house or whatever, where they're all hanging out. They find out that the way the people got the job that they have, who didn't go through the moneylender, is because they already had the skill to do the job.
Right.
So you get into the thing that people always complain about, every teenager in history has experienced, which is, well, how do you get experience when you need experience to get a job? Right.
Right.
That stupid system that exists. Well, like, the, you know, We erased and wiped out the apprenticeship system completely to make sure that wasn't even possible anymore. And so, like, this is essentially the same thing as that, right? This is the apprentice. This is how he has to force himself into this industry, much the way that, like, all the people who have the better jobs in that system, even though they're also just workers, had to force their way into the system, right? By, like, essentially throwing their body onto the machine and hoping that it gives them quote unquote experience rather than chewing them. Like, literally, that's how he got his experience, right? To be a bullfighter is by just fucking throwing himself into the system, into the machine. And that's what those people are describing at that cafeteria table, is basically the same thing, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, the you know, the parallels between what they say about their factory work and him entering the bull ring, the parallels between the job finder, moneylender guy who's taking a cut of everyone's paycheck, to what management is doing to Miguel. You know, it's capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly the same thing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, like, it's... Rossi could not be more explicit about that, barring just literally writing those words on the screen.
Yeah.
Like, right. He's about right. as explicit as you could possibly be in a film without being like, and here's the title card, like the interstitial title card that tells you the point.
Right. Yeah. 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 I think it's to its detriment that the Criterion release only has one bonus feature. That it's a bit
sparse, isn't it?
Yeah.
Considering how high density most of the releases have gotten in the last 100 or so spines.
And it's Rossi doing a career retrospective, so years after this has become one of his minor works, right? He talks about it for 15 minutes, and it's obvious that he remembers making the movie and talks very intricately about it. But I feel like if they had interviewed him in 1966, we'd have more energy about what he's actually attempting to do.
Right.
Maybe 1970. Give it a little time for him not to have to worry about Franco killing him, if he's honest about what
right.
he's doing.
Not but, no longer be in Spain kind of situation,
yeah.
right?
Like, yeah.
But yeah.
Whereas here, with the interview we get, you know, he, like I said, he says, I think I showed Spanish society, but he doesn't really talk about what that means. And, you know, I think it's clear what it means, and Matthew's essay gets into it about how the again, like I've already mentioned, how, you know, just that image of the Virgin Mary statue of
right.
the dozens of poor people forced to carry that thing.
Well, I mean, just the idea that, like, all the poor people are just literally ground underfoot under a giant religious statue is just it's a bit. I mean, in this case, I guess Spanish Catholicism itself is a bit on the nose.
Yeah. And I think there's even one more parallel between that parade with them shuffling under the statue as the army marches behind them to the running of the bulls, right? It's another thing that is happening here. They've got the army marching right behind them. They've got to keep moving.
Well, and not for nothing, the bull, now mind you, I don't buy it, the bull is not a representative of the state. The bull is quite the opposite, but the bull does also trample people underfoot.
I think the bull is representing multiple things here. There is the bull is representative of the state.
Broadly speaking, most 99.9% of the time, the bull represents the sort of caged human,
yes.
right? In the sense that, like, you know, it's being stabbed from all sides at all times until it dies.
Yes.
Seems fairly straightforward in its representation most of the time.
Right. And its survival and Miguel's survival are pitted against one another.
Right. They are mutually exclusive, right?
Right.
And so in that sense, Miguel and the bull are both much like sort of every worker in sort of a capitalist state pitted against each other rather than you know.
Certainly.
Now, if Miguel and the bull combined efforts.
Yeah.
Unstoppable.
Certainly no SPCA seal of approval at the end of this movie. I wonder how many bulls were actually killed for production.
Well, but here's the thing, is I think that's where you get into a really fascinating problem, and you get into sort of like totally understandable that the one cinematographer didn't want to be involved.
Right.
Like, it makes a lot of sense. I wouldn't want to either. I would not want to film this. Flip side of more or fewer or less bulls are not going to be killed to make this movie.
Right.
They are watching a working matador participating in actively happening bullfights. The crowds that are we're watching are real crowds. They're not right. extras brought in.
Right.
Like, it doesn't necessarily, it does not in any way undo the amount of harm that happens in this film. But it is worth noting that, like, it's not like they are instigating the, they are not creating more or less than was already going to exist.
Right, right. They're not.
Nobody's holding any special festivals for them.
Right.
Is what I'm saying. They're not rolling into town like, all right, guys, I need you to drum up a bullfight, okay?
Right.
Like, they don't have to. They can just go from one to another and just film them. It's, yeah. you know, again, I would not want to be the one doing it. But I understand that, like, you kind of get, that's where you kind of get into the sort of documentary elements of it. It's like, well, obviously the documentary can't help but influence the things that it's engaging with, but on this flip side, it's worth always remembering that the goal is to point the camera at the thing that's already happening, right?
For it to be so bad that the cinematographer would willingly go work with Fellini rather than make this movie.
No. Right. I mean, it turns out he was in both, right? He was in Juliet of the Spirits and Eight and a half, according
yeah,
to
I think,
Wikipedia.
Yeah, I think Juliet of the Spirits is the timing one that works out. And obviously,
right,
this
probably,
is,
yeah.
working with Fellini is not... Fellini is not famous for being bad to his cinematographers. So,
No. Fellini, at worst, is going to be maybe drive you insane, but like... But not out of cruelty, I don't
think.
So
I imagine on Juliet of the Spirits, if I remember correctly, he and Mancini were like actively fighting throughout most of that production. So
right.
Because he made her play him in that movie.
Right. Well, as he's wont to do.
Yeah.
As Fellini will do. I feel like, I wonder how long it took people to realize, as a sort of matter of course, that if you're going to be in a Fellini movie, you're probably going to play Fellini.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, how far into his career did you have to get before you're like, oh, shit, I'm going to be playing Fellini. Fuck.
Yes, but I do maintain that making your wife play...
Yeah, fair.
Is
an extra level of cruelty that need not exist, yes.
Yeah. Makes sense if they were fighting during that movie. But yeah, anyway. I don't think Rosie mentions anything else that I really wanted to pick up on.
Well, I mean, what with a, like, it's a career retrospective. Like, I didn't even watch it, but like, I feel like part of the fact that we're engaging now with a quote unquote lesser work.
Yeah.
I think that's sadly unfair to this movie. I think this movie is real. I got a lot out of this.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I took a lot away from this. Like, it's always hard to pin down, like, how much of a movie I'll remember in 10 years or whatever, you know, because, like, God knows some of the movies we talk about after.
Right.
You know, even the best ones. 8 years later, you'd be like, what's the plot of this movie? I'm like, I have no fucking clue.
I remember loving it, but I can't remember a single
thing
about
it. Yeah, I know that if I were to, I know that I liked it then, and I suspect that if I watched it again, I would like it again. Is kind of the general, you know, I'm mostly operating on vibes here, but that being said, like, I feel like I feel kind of sad. It seems like a shame that this movie almost just seems like a footnote. Because right. I think there's something here, you know what I mean? I think there's something valuable here. And it's also possible that there's just, like, even though it was positively reviewed and positively seen at the time, that it just, you know, it's like one of those movies where, like, it's just the wrong place, the wrong time, the zeitgeist just isn't there to keep it in the sort of permanent film lexicon. And as a result, we have a film that is, I really, really, really...
And I will say,
was really into.
I will say that the positive reviews of the time, Pauline Klein writes in 1965, I'm drawing this from quotes from the Peter Matthews essay. She calls it, captured the beauty and the rage of the bullfighting, masterfully rendered in art. Time Magazine's review called it brutal and... a work of brutal and paralyzing beauty. I think they are engaging with it as a bullfighting movie and thinking and engaging right. it as a very well crafted and made bullfighting movie rather than a political work. But Rossi coming off of Salvatore Giuliano and Hands Over the City, he is a political filmmaker. So like you can't pretend this isn't a political work.
Right.
Well, you can, but
yeah, lots of people will do that.
And I'm sure Rossi did for a time until he got the print out of Spain. Had to pretend it wasn't a political work. But we don't even get a story about that, which I'm kind of surprised about, right? Because we've had stories like that before.
Right.
It is a deeply affecting work as a critique of fascism and capitalistic forces. Is a deeply fascinating work that I don't think I can recommend because I don't want to tell anyone else to go watch a whole bunch of bulls die. Just bleed out.
Right. I mean, that's fair.
Get stabbed until their hearts don't work anymore and they just fall over. At least a half dozen times on screen, right? Yeah, it's...
I also kind of wonder if one of the reasons why this movie doesn't sort of last is that, like, the timing is a bit strange, right? Like, we're kind of towards the end of Franco's Spain, right? Like,
we still got a solid 10 years, but sure.
Yeah. Do we?
Yeah, 75. Like,
I've never been
very
clear on the...
Yeah.
Because, like... Yeah, I don't know. It just sort of seems like... I wonder if, like, it's one of those things where you kind of get into this sort of thing where, like, once the sort of pressures that create the thing disappear, the thing itself becomes sort of, like, unclear about its own purpose, sort of, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
And that now that we've sort of looped back around, like, now that sort of the modern state neoliberal world order thing is sort of collapsing all around us at all times, it feels more engaging again because it's like, well... We just live in the thing that this movie's talking about, like,
right,
permanently now. Like, we're all just in this mire all the time now.
Yeah.
And in many ways, if you think about the fact that, like, when you look at, like, the 70s outside of Spain, other audiences are going to maybe not understand some of those pressures as clearly as they could because we really haven't seen those establishments collapse yet, really. They're still functioning in a lot of ways in the way that they're intended to.
Yeah.
And your audience goes and watches it, and they don't feel the pressures that the movie's meant to talk about in the
right.
same way that perhaps
yeah.
Rossi wants people to.
I wonder if there is a Spanish scholarly class that revisits this movie as a critique of Franco within Spanish history.
Right.
That is not something we get in an English language release.
Right. Yeah, we're just not going to get. We're not going to see.
Yeah.
This. I could see a world where you're like somebody's got this like in a Spanish university
yeah.
somewhere. This is like
but then,
part of the sort of the text of yeah. the university or something like that.
But then Rossi not being Spanish, being an Italian, being an outsider to this.
Right,
you know,
right.
There might also be focus on, you know, actual Spanish film.
Well, that's fair. I mean, you know, I mean, but then again, like, who knows, right? But you kind of get into this thing where, like, well, the only person who could even get a free enough hand to make
right.
even something as sort of light touch critique as this can be at times, well, a foreigner was the only person who could even get that much
right.
to happen. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing, right? Is that, like, you don't get... It is hard to find internal critiques of fascist states for a reason.
Yeah.
They do tend to do bad things to the people who try to do that.
Right, right, right.
And it seems to be part and parcel of the whole fascism thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It does feel like after this, Rossi does continue to make pretty political movies. In 1970, he makes a movie called Many Wars Ago as a title for a movie about the futility of war. Pretty great. We will eventually watch Christ Stop at Eboli. That is our next Criterion release from Rossi. It is distant future. I think it's in the 10th, the 1000s. But That is a 1979 movie that deals with Italian fascism pretty directly too. I think it takes place in the 30s, but yeah. So, you know, I think given its subtlety, given that it's about Spain and not directly about Italy, I can understand this falling by the wayside in Rossi's career
as far as
people looking at it. I am very happy that it is among the pieces that Criterion has chosen to show us. I bet it did not have a lot of wide showing before Criterion put it out, right?
I would guess that's true. Yeah.
It's something they could get. I mean, just look at as you've mentioned, the English Wikipedia page is like a total of 3 sentences.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's one of the shortest one we've had in a long time.
Half the word count is cast.
I mean, I got news for you. The Italian one is too.
Yeah. The Italian one doesn't have much more.
Sentences long.
There's a Welsh one that's longer, but half of that one seems to be biography of Rossi. It's just very...
There appears to be no Spanish one at all.
Right. Yeah. So some interesting things going on there as far as this film's legacy, just in the amount of people willing to put time to talk about it on Wikipedia. That has never been an indication of how good or bad a movie is.
No, but it is usually a decent indication of how well known the film is. That there are people to put things on there about it. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, it's. I find it very interesting. It's as hard as it is to watch. It's very interesting. And it is hard to watch.
Right, yeah, so. I mean, it is a difficult watch, but at the same time, like, to a certain extent, because I kind of told myself the story at the beginning that, like, I know Rossi's not making these things happen.
Right.
I can kind of deal with it a little bit better because it's like, well, I understand that this is a part of the Spanish culture and, like, me not liking it isn't going to change it in any capacity.
Yeah. And I'm glad that Rossi did not approach this as a straight documentary, because I would not want to see Rossi approach this in a even quasi neutral stance, right?
I think to a certain extent, you're right in the sense that, like, adding in the and I think you see this in the fact that Rossi felt compelled to do this,
right?
Adding in the narrative allows Rossi to attach his values to it in a way that prevents it from being more valorized than it is, right? In the sense that, like, just doing a straight documentary would increase the risk that everybody who watches it would just be like, well, yeah, I mean, I, you know, wasn't it awesome that I got to watch the bullfights on in film, right? So well rendered in film. Whereas adding a narrative allows him to at least criticize the sort of like societal structures that make this happen and make it happen in the way that it happens.
Yeah. Well, this is a pretty short episode, but I don't really know that I have a lot.
Because much like the Wikipedia page is short, but also, like, the reality of the matter is that, as we said, this movie has what, like, 1,000 words of dialogue?
Yeah.
Maybe. I think I'm stretching it. I don't know that it's that much.
Right.
Like, the reality of the matter is that so much of the movie is experiential, right? Like, the movie visually conveys to you the brutality of what's happening, both to the bull and to Miguel.
There's one other thing I want to mention, because I also feel it is an example. I think all of Miguel's interactions with women he's not related to are parodies of what those interactions would be. When he goes back home and is helping with the harvest, and the teenage girl comes up to him and gives him water.
Right.
And we get these, like, it's almost shot like it's going to be some sort of meet cute.
Right. Well, yeah, the movie kind of fucks with you a little bit, right?
And then she just, and then she says, "You're Miguel, aren't you?" And then walks away. It's so good.
Yeah, well, it's a really weird scene. It's a fascinating scene because, like, there's so much, like, weirdness in it. Like, she's very clearly, like, a young teen, right? Like, she's, looks like she's, like, 13, 14 years old.
Right.
So we as an audience already are, like, kind of like, this is weird. Comfortable with
what
this. But then, like, it's more that, like, Miguel has been deprived of even acquiring the, like, social skills to even talk to women at all. Like, you know, what we really get out of it is, oh, this is a person who's been actively, purposely stunted in his, like, emotional growth by the people around him preventing him from forming human attachments, right?
Right.
Like, he's, like, he can't.
And he can't.
And in many ways, we kind of come to understand Miguel as being sort of socially on the same level as this 14-year-old girl or whatever. Like, it's like, oh, he's not progressed at all from, like, the immature man who went to the city when he was, like, 17 or whatever to try to get a job.
Right, right. He can't even interact with her as a fan, right? He can't interact
with her. He can't interact with her in any capacity, right? And we see him do that. She's a, like, a shining example because we've removed him from a lot of the other structures that are around him. He's just there. They're just, it's just two people having a conversation in the middle of a field. Like, there's no other things like influences and pressures on there, but we can see it, like, shine through just how stunted and, like, incapable of human connection he is at that point. Whereas in other places, that's hard to pick up on because everything's so busy and he's running around all the time, right?
Right.
And it just sort of kind of serves to highlight that like, oh yeah, like, this guy just, they've deprived him of the ability to, like, grow as a human being.
Right.
Like, and then we get this, and of course that becomes a critique of, like, well, what, you know, the way the capital alienates people from their fellow man, right? Like,
right.
And so, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and the only person, you know, we see him sort of have sexual relationships twice. One is with a woman who is, what do you think is the dollar value of 100 lira or 100 pesetas?
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that scene because that's so early because he doesn't even have, like, he's not doing the matador thing yet. It's just like.
So she's just trying to get money out of him. And then
I'm unclear if we're supposed to understand her as a prostitute directly.
Yeah, I think she
Or more in a kind of, like, pseudo, like, socialized sense or something like that.
Yeah. Whether it's for sex or if it's just for accompaniment, I don't know that it matters,
right. Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. It's is it like 100 lira because we're gonna, like, go off and have a good time, or you know, it's hard
it's
to say.
It's not lira,
but, like,
it's pesetas. But yeah, lira
is. I don't know, man. In my head, I also thought lira, but I don't know.
Lira is Italian, so if this were actually shot in Italy, it would be lira. But
well, we were watching Rossi, and, like,
Yeah.
Our brains broke.
But yeah, and then the other, you know, sexual encounter is with Linda, a woman who views him as a curiosity, a plaything to be conquered. He doesn't get to have human relationships with anyone, and that is an aspect of the capitalistic hellscape that he finds himself in. So anyway. Like I said, this is kind of a short episode, but I think we've talked it out. Fantastic movie. If you can stomach a whole bunch of bull blood everywhere. And some human blood, but presumably that's less real. Usually.
I think the last one.
Yeah. I don't think they actually gored him in the stomach for the film, but...
Right, exactly. That's what I'm saying is it's like, well, you know, the last scene where we dramatically need him to die might be the only blood that's not real.
The Moment of Truth by Francisco Rossi from 1965. Next week, we will be talking about another Japanese movie. had Godzilla last week, and next week is Three Outlaw Samurai, Hideo Gosha's film from 1964, a film adaptation of a television series from the time. It's been a while since we've gotten to watch a samurai movie.
Right.
Can't really
it
wait.
It has been a while.
Love a samurai movie. Thank you, Criterion, for bringing us another
one. For giving us one, finally. It's been a while, yeah.
Yeah. So, look forward to that. Thank you so much for listening to Lost in Criterion. I'm, as always, the Adam Glass. With me, as always, John Patrick Otari Dorian. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Lost in Criterion with co-hosts The Adam Glass and John Patrick Oetari Dorgan. With the collapse of Twitter, who knows what social media we might end up at. How about Blue Sky? That sounds great. Check out the official podcast account at lostincriterion.bsky.social. Jonathan Hape does our music, and you can check out more of his work at jonathan-hape.com or on any music streaming service. And you probably should. He's pretty good. A big thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon. You can join their ranks at patreon.com/lostincriterion. And hey, thank you for listening.